For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is an encore edition of Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, follow the tracks of an extinct species of giant bear. I'll talk with Mike Stark about chasing the ghost bear on the trail of America's lost super beast. Meet 12-year-old Tobias from Parks, Arizona, who created his own epic movie studio at home, featuring dinosaurs, flying saucers, Godzilla, and lots of Lego. And explore a different side of desert geology through the poetry of Susan Cummins Miller and Making Silent Stones Sing. Those stories are next on Arizona Spotlight. Mike Stark is a journalist and the creative director for the Center for Biological Diversity. He's passionate about ecology, and to write his new book, he had to hike and cave in some pretty remote and inhospitable places. Chasing the Ghost Bear on the Trail of America's Lost Super Beast shares Mike Stark's obsession with the now extinct giant short-faced bear. Before our conversation, he'll read an excerpt from the book.
No one stumbles across Potter Creek Cave. Tucked into a mountainside high above Shasta Lake in Northern California, it's a hidden place, a hole fit into a limestone hill that's so well concealed by trees and thick bushes that you don't know you've arrived until you're practically on its front doorstep. Inside are narrow, twisting passages, pits, galleries of pale stalactites, slick walls, bats, millipedes, eyeless spiders, and the kind of deep darkness that leaves you disoriented and trying to remember why anyone would ever willingly part with the daylight. It's perfect for secrets. Plenty had come to Potter Creek Cave before me, people and animals alike. The chambers and galleries once housed a staggering trove of bones, numbering in the thousands, representing at least 52 species. Animals still extant were well represented in the fragments, including rats, bats, deer, and rattlesnakes. Scattered among the debris and bound by the blackness for thousands of years were also the remains of more than 20 extinct species, exotic and familiar. Camels, horses, giant sloths, ancient bison, dire wolves, mammoths, and mastodons. Vestiges all from the Pleistocene, the epoch from roughly 2.6 million years ago to 11,700 years ago, famous for its massive, intermittent glaciers that draped over much of North America, and for the oddball assortment of oversized, outlandish creatures that stalked the landscape. Most of the extinct species found in the cave were already known to scientists by the time they were discovered in the late 1800s and early 1900s. One was not. Its discovery, in the form of a roughed-up skull missing its lower jaw, was the first sign of the biggest flesh-eating mammal ever to walk the continent. The largest of its kind, the males, stood taller than polar bears and the mighty brown bears of Alaska, and possessed jaws powerful enough to annihilate skulls and snap bones like dry twigs. On all fours, the biggest stared a 6-foot person in the face. On its hind legs, it towered 10 feet or more and could reach its front paws up to 15 feet. It sported claws like knife blades and teeth built for tearing and shredding. Trifling with this bear could certainly come with ugly, often life-ending results. Any Ice Age person lucky enough to survive an encounter would have returned to their family with a story equal parts terror, adrenaline, and awe. No one alive knows today what its roar sounded like, but it's safe to assume it curdled bowels and triggered a flight response like no other. It's no wonder that some have speculated the mere presence of this barely believable bear in the far north may have delayed the arrival of people in the interior of North America for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years.
Of all the animals that you could have gone chasing, why this bear?
Well, these bears were forgotten characters from the Pleistocene. When we think about this time in the Earth's history, we often think of mammoths and mastodons and the saber-toothed tigers and lions, camels, other species. But this giant short-faced bear has kind of been lost to our memory for a long time. And bears have always been a very special species to me. When I'm out in the wild, when I'm hiking, I've always got my ear out for the crack of a twig that maybe is going to signify a bear in our midst. Or, you know, I love seeing in places like Yellowstone where you can see the rump of a bear on a ridge and know that this is, you're in their place, you're in their habitat. And so all growing up and in my adult life, being in the presence of bears has always been really special to me.
What are some of its unique biological adaptations?
Well, all bears are incredible. All bears are highly adaptable, incredible improvisers on the landscape where they live. The giant short-faced bear was different than a lot of the bears that we know, is a little bit more slender, is a little bit more cat-like or even hyena-like in some ways. So it doesn't look like a really big grizzly bear. It doesn't really even look like a polar bear necessarily. And so they had longer legs. They had shorter snouts. And so those longer legs allowed them to travel across the landscape farther distances in search of food. I think they had incredible noses like all bears do. And so this was really a species that was built for long-range travel in search of food. And then when it got to wherever it was going to be, finding food it can eat and adapting to the local plants or animals.
Can you tell us a little about the trip that you took, the places you visited while you were researching this bear?
The first place I went, I wanted to see where this bear first showed up for people, where the first specimen was found. And so my first trip was to Northern California, to Potter Creek Cave. And it was a long, rainy day hiking up this side of this mountain to get to the cave's entrance. And then inside, deep into the cave, there was a big, dark pit where for thousands of years, animals had been falling into the pit from a hole in the surface and spending their last moments there, down there in the dark. And so among them were giant short-faced bears, and that's where the first skull was found in 1879. And I went to Rochester, Indiana. That was where the most complete specimen has ever been found. That was back in 1967, where a gas crew was installing a valve on a pipeline and were digging around in the muck, and suddenly bears emerged from the mud and our bones of bear emerged from the mud.
I was going to say, you made it sound extremely dramatic.
That would be exciting if maybe that was the last one still remaining. So that was where a skeleton was found by that utility crew. So that was another place I visited. I went to Lubbock, Texas. That was important to me because that's where one of the few associations between people and giant short-faced bears has been found. So at a place called Lubbock Lake, there's a museum there. They think there's evidence that a leg bone was found that had been broken by somebody over a rock and used to scrape the hide of a mammoth or a mastodon or some other species that had been killed there. And so it's important to me to go to that place to know that the bears had been there, known that humans had been interacting with bears in some ways. And also one of my favorite places was the La Brea Tar Pits in downtown Los Angeles, which is just such a surreal place to go in the heart of L.A., where there's buses going past and Starbucks and all sorts of human development. And right in the middle is this amazing death pit that operated for 50,000 years, where animals kept getting stuck in the goo and dying. And it's become one of the best places to find giant short-faced bear bones.
There are a lot of great turns of phrase in your book. Your writing is very short and punchy, and I can't write a description without putting at least two adjectives in there. You're able to describe things without doing that. It's very impressive to me. But there's a short quote in the book that stood out to me, and it's, "Paleontology is hunting without killing." And the reason I bring it up is because in your career as a naturalist and a journalist, what was it like to go looking for something that you knew you actually weren't going to find?
Yeah, that's a great question. That quote was from Russell Shapiro, who was a paleontologist from California State University, who went with me to the Potter Creek Cave. And I think that's one of the most fascinating thing about reconstructing the past. You know, and one of the things I learned talking to paleontologists and being with them in the field and elsewhere is that they are finding scraps and trying to assemble scraps into a story. And that's a lot of what this book ended up being as well, is looking for disparate facts about the giant short-faced bear and trying to understand what the big long-term narrative was for this bear and piecing it together. But I did find myself really wishing to encounter this bear the more I got to know about it. And there was something of a grieving process, strange as it is to say, that that I was on a trail of a bear that no longer existed and trying to look for signs of life from something that was no longer there. And, you know, extinction is like that. We suffer these losses we didn't even know that we've lost. And knowing that I was in the place where these bears existed, a blink of an eye ago, really, 10,000, 20,000 years ago, in the geological sense, was just a fleck of time for us. So I had this sense that I was in close proximity with these bears. They were just here. I felt like I just missed them. I was bummed that I can't see them. And so the next best thing is to try to piece together what their lives were like and who they were. And for me, that was my way of getting as close as I could to them.
So coming right off of that, Mike, in one of the reviews of the book, it's referred to as partly a meditation on extinction. Do you think about extinction differently after this experience?
Absolutely. I think it's, I take it more personally. I think every extinction is a loss of the great piece of art that this world is. And I think as you take each piece away, this becomes a less vibrant, less alive place to be. Right in the middle of being in the field for this book, the United Nations came out with a report that predicted that up to 1 million species could be gone in the next few decades. You know, the giant short-faced bear was not driven extinct probably by people, but a lot of the species that we talk about now with extinction, a lot of those are preventable. And so for me, these are, you know, these bears became a friend in my life as I was researching and writing this book. And I view all the other species out there as friends, whether I know them or not. And so as birds disappear, as frogs disappear, as fish disappear and plants, I feel like all of these are personal losses for me. And once you start experiencing extinction like that, it becomes pretty profound and you do feel yourself really going through a grieving process.
Mike Stark is the author of Chasing the Ghost Bear, On the Trail of America's Lost Super Beast, published by University of Nebraska Press. Who says you need millions to bring dinosaurs back to life? Hailing from the town of Parks, Tobias is a 12-year-old who found a way to combine several of his favorite interests with the power of his imagination. He's been making his own movies and sharing them on YouTube, picking up all the filmmaking skills he needs as he goes along. His specialty is giant monsters, prehistoric dino epics, made with the complex and patience-testing art of stop-motion animation. I asked Tobias to tell us how he got started.
I guess I watched many YouTube videos of the same format, and I got inspired. And since I like making movies, I decided to just work with what I got, try to buy the things that I need, and just make a movie.
Tell us about your appreciation or your interest in dinosaurs.
I don't know. When I was like really young, I watched Jurassic Park, and that really got me into dinosaurs. And then I consider myself to have a very deep appreciation for the animals because I just adore learning about them. And they're fascinating, just like everything about them, basically.
Can you name some of the dinosaur species that you've used in your films?
My most recent film, I used Stegosaurus and Allosaurus. And in my other films, I used Tyrannosaurus Rex, Ceratosaurus, Herrerasaurus, Clovisaurus, and like a T-Rex figure, which I was using as a replacement for Disputosaurus.
Have you watched early stop-motion films? Has anyone ever shown you King Kong?
Well, I haven't seen the original yet, but I do plan on it.
You'll learn a lot from watching it. And you'll also be aware of something that animators know about, that it's really hard to do stop-motion animation with something that has fur.
Yeah.
Explain it to people who are listening why that would be tricky.
Well, the way I see it, with fur, it's loose, so because you constantly have to touch the figure to move it, the fur would constantly be moving and shifting around.
Precisely.
I think the fur shifting around is kind of adds to the charm of it.
Yeah, there is a lot of charm to stop motion. What else would you say you've really come to appreciate from this form?
Well, I just appreciate the talent, the effort, the patience that goes into stop motion animation. Like, you need to make the figures, and you got to make them perfect, and then you got to take up a lot of your time and effort into making sure the stop motion looks as smooth as you can get it.
You also combine music and even digital effects to make your films. Tell us about that, about how you've been adding to the number of skills and the number of techniques that you've been able to use.
I use iMovie and Stop Motion Pro 2, I believe, on the computer. And they really help me because, with iMovie, I can add in sound effects and music. And with Stop Motion Pro 2, I can add in drawn-in effects to make the overall product look better.
And maybe we should warn some of our more meek viewers that when your dinosaurs fight, there's often blood as a result.
Yeah, I'm all for realistic depictions. So if I feel like a certain scene needs to be bloody, I'm not afraid to make it bloody because I want my audience to feel for whoever's in the scene. I want to have just this impact.
And I've seen you use different techniques to create the blood. I think I've seen you use digital tools to do it. You've used clay to represent blood and injuries. And you also mixed up some formula of your own, I think, for one of your films.
Well, yeah, I think it's been a while, but I think I got it off of a YouTube video. Corn syrup, red dye, a drop of blue dye, and then some water, and then you just mix it to make it look like real blood.
So of the techniques that you've used to do it, which do you think was the most effective? Which one were you proudest of in the end?
Well, to be honest, I'm proud of all of them. I feel like they work for different purposes. Like, the more realistic blood is for my dinosaur stuff. My clay and digital blood is for my kaiju stuff.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. So what are your goals right now as a filmmaker? What do you want to do next, or are you working on a big project you want to tell us about?
I'm finishing off this 2-year-old series. So once I finish that, I'm going to try to work on a possible 5-movie franchise, Godzilla franchise.
Yeah.
That I'm going to use figures for. And I'm also going to be planning on a dinosaur documentary with stop motion puppets if I can learn how to build them.
Well, that sounds very ambitious. And if people want to check out your YouTube channel, what kind of content do you offer?
Toy movies, stop motion movies, dinosaur reviews, and Lego how to builds. And I will be trying to do little movie discussion videos in the near future. So that'll be something I'll be adding soon.
You can find all of the short films made by Tobias on his YouTube page. It's called Jurassic Studios. Tusonan Susan Cummins Miller identifies as a geologist and an author of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Her collection, Making Silent Stones Sing, connects these pursuits with ley lines of both attention and intention. I started by asking her how that came to be.
I think it's a chicken and an egg thing. I was raised in a family of storytellers, poets, and writers. So it was never something odd for me. We heard poetry around the dinner table. We heard poetry around the campfire. We recited it. And when I was 9, I started writing poetry, none of which, thank heavens, has survived. And then I got more and more into the things I was studying, and there wasn't any time. So I put it aside. But I think the need to pay attention, which is what links the two for me. You're paying attention to what's in place when you're a poet. You're paying attention to place from the standpoint of what is physically there when you're doing geology and paleontology. Gathering clues at the surface of the earth, you're extrapolating backwards in time to create a story of what happened in that place over time, the fourth dimension. And I think you're exploring through poetry in a really similar fashion. Those two fields were never at odds. It was just one would be in the background.
Please share with us a poem from your recent collection called Making Silent Stones Sing.
The poem I'm going to read is called The Bone Man's Apprentice. Between Route 66 and the old Spanish Trail, we hiked serrated ridges, discovering a cache of fossil bones preserved on a limey sandstone ledge in the heart of the Mojave. Under your watchful eye, I chiseled away the barren protective strata, exposing teeth and dimpled bone, a horse's skull, no longer than my hand, concealed for 18 million years. With clear drops of glyptol, I sealed the fragile fragments. You showed me how to swaddle the delicate palate in layers of TP, how to mix the plaster of Paris. I poured tepid canteen water into the dented basin, added pale gray powder that smelled like kindergarten, warmed numb fingers in the exothermic reaction, dipped strips of rough brown burlap in the thick white soup. Laughing, we smoothed the gooey paste on fossil and rock pedestal, our fingers and forearms taking on the virginal hue until neither of us could identify where our bodies ended and the sun-bleached hills began.
Well, one of the simple joys you get to experience in the poetry in this book is using words of science like glyptol in your poetry. I mean, even plaster of Paris, which is something we probably all had some kind of experience with, it's a little bit of vocabulary that many poets don't get to use.
It's true. It doesn't matter what field you're entering, but let's take geology and paleontology. It is a vocabulary not everyone speaks. But to access the experience, it's helpful to be able to bring in things we use like burlap, which everybody knows, plaster of Paris, which our children used to put handprints in to give their mothers on Mother's Day, right? Those things people can access easily with their vocabulary, whatever it is.
And their tactile memory.
And their tactile memory, which is important. Being a scientist and being a poet, it's accessing in the present, using all the senses to investigate, to experience that particular moment.
I would like for you to read for us again from the book.
I'm going to read the eponymous poem, Making Silent Stones Sing. 1. Picture Rocks Canyon. paisley scarlet bandana caught on gray thornbush, sprouting from naked rock. Lavender blooming ironwoods, swift zebra-tailed lizards, and always the cactus wrens for company. 2. If you sit where basalt layers first enter the canyon, clear your mind, focus on nothing. You'll discover a faint figure pecked in black patina, elongated body, arms upraised, feet planted firmly on nothing but ground mass. Nearby, inscribed on other smooth outcrops, circles and loops, squares and rectangles, messages left by archaic writers. How many hundred times have you trudged by without stopping, intent on completing the loop trail, a metaphorical circle beginning and ending in your room? 3. Note to self. If it is the journey that matters and not the arbitrary destination, then remember the magic in this impromptu stop. And before you leave, place your hand on the petroglyphs. Acknowledge the spark leaping artist to artist and making silent stones sing.
Susan Cummins Miller is the author of Making Silent Stones Sing, published by Finishing Line Press. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM radio studios. AZPM's news director is Christopher Conover. The music is by Calexico. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. Production assistance by Leah Britton. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.